The Trinity Western case goes to the Supreme Court this week.
The discrimination that's happening here in this case is not against LGBTQ people, but against evangelical Christians who associate with Trinity Western University. And the discrimination that's happening is by state actors, by the Law Society in BC and the Law Society in Ontario. That's a proper understanding of discrimination. But discrimination and association are two sides of the same coin. Freedom of association is protected in the Charter in Section 2D. So to associate with other people of like mind requires, in a sense, setting a distinction between yourselves and others. That's what association means. It's actually a logical and necessary component of freedom of association.
On the feature today, ARPA lawyer Andre Schutten on what's turned into a watermark case about charter rights. In the news, two important affirmations of parental rights in education this week. One in a court ruling in Ontario, the other in a resolution at the United Nations. And ARPA is out with a new policy report, this one on in vitro fertilization.
And now, Lighthouse News. Lighthouse News is a presentation of ARPA, the Association for Reform Political Action. Here's your host, Al Sebring.
The Ontario Court of Appeal has released a decision in a case with major implications for parental rights in education. A father in Hamilton, referred to in court documents only as E.T., had asked the Hamilton Public School Board for advance notification when certain subjects were to be taught so that he could remove his children from classes if the content were to conflict with his sincerely held religious beliefs. A lower court had turned down the request, and this week, a three-judge panel of the Ontario Court of Appeal issued its ruling in the case. Derek Ross is the general counsel and executive director of Christian Legal Fellowship. He appeared before the court as an intervener in support of the father, and he says the ruling is a mixed result because the dad's specific complaint was rejected.
He agrees that the acceptance of others is a necessary virtue to teach. But what he does not want is his children to be indoctrinated in the view that acceptance of others requires full endorsement of all of their choices. The court looked at the evidence, and they said in this particular case, it doesn't appear that this actually occurred in the classroom. There didn't appear to be any evidence that this sort of teaching had actually transpired. But they did leave the door open. They said if there is evidence that students are being pressured to abandon their religious convictions or are being taught in such a manner that undermines the parents' ability to transmit their faith to their children, the result could very well have been a different one.
And that, Ross says, means that the overall tone of the ruling was very encouraging when it came to affirming parental rights.
The language that the majority used and some of the comments they provided us, I think, are extremely helpful. I think this case serves as a very important precedent affirming parental rights in education. The claimant was unsuccessful for evidentiary reasons, but the majority did make it very clear that his concerns were legitimate and that a future case could very well have a different result depending on the evidence. So why do I say it's a helpful case? First, the majority made it very clear that parents have primary authority for making decisions about the well-being for their children, and that the state's authority is secondary to that parental right. And they also said that the authority of the state to educate children is a delegated authority, and that delegation comes from parents. So parents can choose to homeschool or send their children to private school. They don't have to participate in public education. So the decision has some very strong and, in my view, very welcome language affirming parental rights and emphasizing that there are really clear limits on what the government can do to interfere with those rights.
The case may not be done yet. There's a possibility the evidentiary ruling on the father's specific complaint could be appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada. On a related topic, a surprise last week at the United Nations Committee on Social, Humanitarian, and Cultural Issues. A group of countries, primarily from Africa, spearheaded the blocking of a resolution that affirmed the rights of children to self-determination when it came to sexual and reproductive health issues. The group also inserted language that insisted on the primacy of parental rights when it came to issues of sex education. Several member states reaffirmed their belief that parents have to play a central role in education. Singapore's delegate stressed that the upbringing of children was best done by parents and legal guardians. The motion on parental rights passed by a vote of 90-76. Even the Russian Federation voted in favor. Canada opposed that motion. We've got complete details on the motion and the deliberations at the UN on two links from the Lighthouse News homepage this week. ARPA is out with a new respectfully submitted policy report. This one deals with in vitro fertilization. Lawyer John Sikkema says there's still considerable debate about the ethics of the practice itself, but the report doesn't address that. Rather, he says it deals with policy issues that flow out of the fact that in vitro fertilization is going on, and that there are ethical questions arising out of the practice in general.
This report acknowledges those ethical discussions about whether or not IVF is ethical. We don't try to resolve that debate. It's a debate which is even occurring among Christians, but we do at least take the basic premise that the law should ensure that basic ethical standards govern the creation of human life, and the ethical standard that is at the core of this report is that the intentional destruction, or even the negligent or wanton destruction of human life, is unethical. So how are we dealing with embryos created outside of the womb? What is happening to them? How are we creating them? What is their connection to their genetic parents, if any? And what are they being used for? So we deal with things like experimentation, discarding embryos, freezing embryos, and those kinds of things. There's a lot of gaps in our law, and that's the main policy concern that we're addressing with this report.
The report's been distributed to lawmakers across the country. Sikkema says there hasn't been any response indicating anybody wants to take up the cause, but that's not surprising.
We intend to have a lobbying effort on this as well, to set up meetings with people. You know, we have a number of recommendations in this report. We certainly don't expect all of them to be set out in a bill, say, right away. But piece by piece, these are things to work on in the law in order to establish greater respect and protections for in vitro embryos.
We link to a copy of the report from the Lighthouse News homepage this week. Back with more after this.
ARPA has launched a 12-step action plan, a challenge with 12 steps, one for each month of the year, that will help you to build a relationship with one of your government representatives. Whether it's your MP, MPP, MLA, councillor, or mayor, relationships are very important for political involvement. November is month number 2, and this month we're all sending out an email to our one chosen representative. You can do this at easy.arpacanada.ca. Also, find out more at arpacanada.ca/12steps.
ARPA's Director of Law and Policy, Andre Schouten, is preparing to appear before the Supreme Court of Canada again. ARPA has been granted intervener status in 2 Trinity Western University appeals regarding a law school in British Columbia. We've got Andre Schouten on the program.
Thanks for having me back, Al.
So, 2 days from now, the Supreme Court of Canada starts its hearings on the Trinity Western University case. For folks who may have just arrived on this scene late, run through some of the fundamentals here. What's this about?
Essentially, Trinity Western University, a Christian university, wants to start the first ever Christian law school. It's actually the first ever religious law school that's not one of the pre-existing 22 secular law schools in Canada. And they were approved to do that by both the National Federation of Law Societies of Canada, as well as the Minister of Higher Education in BC. Both of those bodies determined that Trinity Western's law school program, as proposed, was completely compatible with the practice of law in Canada. However, 3 law societies in British Columbia, in Ontario, and in Nova Scotia all said, well, we don't like the community covenant at Trinity Western. We don't like that this is a Christian university that takes their faith seriously and requires their students and their staff to live according to biblical virtue. And because of that, they said, we will not recognize that law degree. So this has been challenged in the courts in BC, Ontario, and in Nova Scotia at the lower level, at the courts of appeal. And now 2 of the matters, the Court of Appeal decision in BC, where Trinity Western won, and the Court of Appeal decision in Ontario, where Trinity Western lost, both of those 2 decisions have now been appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada, where they hopefully will answer the question for us in a clear way. Can law societies discriminate against Trinity Western University and its law degree simply on the basis of its faith commitments?
ARPA is an intervener in this case. We've been granted the intervener status. What's the fundamental point of the arguments that ARPA is bringing to the table?
I want to focus in on that question of discrimination. The other side on this issue, they keep saying that Trinity Western University is the one who discriminates. They say that their faith community or their faith covenant discriminates against particularly LGBTQ individuals, but also against others. And my argument is that no, this discrimination that's happening here in this case is not against LGBTQ people, but against evangelical Christians who associate with Trinity Western University. And the discrimination that's happening is by state actors, by the Law Society in BC and the Law Society in Ontario. That's a proper understanding of discrimination. But discrimination and association are two sides of the same coin. Freedom of association is protected in the Charter in Section 2D. So to associate with other people of like mind, as Trinity Western is doing, that requires, in a sense, setting a distinction between yourselves and others. That's what association means. It's actually a logical and necessary component of freedom of association. And so in order to understand which side of the coin you're looking at, is this legal discrimination or is this association, freedom of association, you need to follow legal tests, legal analysis in order to come to that decision. You don't follow emotional gut feelings, you follow legal tests. And that's where we're hoping to direct the Supreme Court to really focus in on what is the legal test. The law is on the side of Trinity Western. Follow those legal tests and Trinity Western should win.
There's another wrinkle here. The president of Trinity Western sent a letter to the alumni earlier this month, and I'm just going to quote from it here briefly. He says, the Law Society of Upper Canada in Ontario now says that the Supreme Court must reject Trinity Western, not just because of the position on marriage, in other words, that community covenant, but also because of the university's distinctly Christian environment. In its written argument filed with the Supreme Court, the Law Society highlighted every part of the community covenant it found discriminatory, and the first two highlighted words were Jesus Christ. Kuhn writes that it's become apparent that along with the Christian virtues that the university commits to practice, the Law Society also wants to prohibit the very faith that distinguishes the university. I guess, first of all, is this a new development, a new wrinkle in this case? And secondly, how do you read that whole thing?
There's definitely a new development. I mean, that argument has not yet been made in the lower courts. And in a sense, I'm actually kind of confused by it. It seems to me that the Law Society of Upper Canada is overplaying their hand by suggesting that a Christian university cannot be Christian, cannot say that they confess faith in Jesus Christ. That to me is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, surely freedom of religion would suggest that we can believe not just personally and privately in the privacy of our own homes or our own bedrooms that we believe in Jesus Christ, but it can shape our entire life and that we can confess it publicly and not be punished or marginalized or treated differently because of it. So it seems to me an overplay on the side of the Law Society of Upper Canada. But at the same time, it's basically a twisted view of secularism. It's a view that thinks, and this is actually quite dominant in Quebec out of their cultural tradition of the last 60 years or so, and that is a particular view of secularism. So there's two different views of secularism. One is a view of secularism that's very pluralistic. It says that the civil state, the government, will not take a position on religion, but allow all faith traditions to contribute in a robust way out of their own faith tradition and do so freely. But there's another much more radical form of secularism, which is being reflected in that argument by the Law Society, which says that secularism means to stamp out all religious expressions of faith and to make everybody quote-unquote neutral by eliminating any references to faith. And that's a wrong view of secularism. It's not been endorsed by our Supreme Court yet. In fact, they've endorsed the opposite. They've endorsed a type of secularism that's pluralist, and that allows all faith communities to express themselves out of their tradition without compromise.
So you've got two more days. I'm assuming all the arguments are pretty much together and you've rehearsed what you're going to say. What can folks do between now and Thursday and as this thing progresses?
There's only one thing left to do, Al, and that's to pray. You know, the lawyers can prepare as best they can, but at the end of the day, this is a decision that rests with nine judges sitting on the Supreme Court, the nine most powerful legal minds of the country. And we know that in the hands of the Lord is the heart of the king, and I would say the heart of the nine Supreme Court judges, and he can direct them as he sees fit. So we entreat our listeners to please pray for wisdom for these judges, for minds and hearts that are open to the concerns of the Christian community in this particular case. And pray that God would continue to protect religious freedom in this country, not so that Christians can live a life of ease, but so that the gospel can go out in Canada unaffected, unhindered, so that many more Canadians can come to know the love and joy and peace of Jesus Christ.
Sure, I thank you.
Thanks so much, Al.
This has been Lighthouse News, delivering news and commentaries on today's current events to equip Christians for their task in the public square. Questions or feedback? You can leave us an audio comment by going to our homepage, www.lighthousenews.ca, and clicking on the answering machine button at the top of the page. Or you can send us an email, lighthousenews@arpacanada.ca. Be sure to join us again next week for another edition of Lighthouse News.